Radio Catskill. From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, diseases that actually have vaccines to prevent them are increasing. Last night, we talked to Sullivan County's Director of Public Health about the advisory they issued after measles was detected in neighboring Orange County. And tonight, Patricio Robayo talks to Dr. Richard Besser, former CDC Director and current President and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, about vaccine education in a time of declining support for public health. Coming up, we also have continuing analysis of and reaction to New York State's recently passed budget. And we learn how one local conservation group feels about what is and is not in that budget. First up, let's check in with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. You might know them as FEMA. I was actually at FEMA's website this afternoon to see how they're doing, FEMA.gov. They have a prominent note that saying that now is the time to prepare for hurricane season because that starts June 1st. But above that was another prominent note with a big exclamation point saying, quote, FEMA.gov is being updated to comply with President Trump's executive orders. Thank you for your patience and understanding, end quote. In fact, cuts and layoffs are impacting all of FEMA, not just its website, and these cuts are also sparking local concerns as hurricane and wildfire seasons approach. How the federal government and local governments respond to disasters could be changing, too. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar has this report.
FEMA is undergoing big changes. Last week, the acting FEMA administrator Cameron Hamilton testified at a House committee oversight hearing that he did not believe FEMA should be eliminated, which President Trump has advocated for. The following day, Hamilton was immediately fired and replaced with David Richardson, just weeks before the hurricane and summer wildfire seasons are set to begin. Here's Hamilton testifying at the House committee meeting on May 7th.
As the senior advisor to the president on disasters and emergency management and to the Secretary of Homeland Security, I do not believe it is in the best interest of the American people to eliminate the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Okay.
Having said that, I'm not in a position to make decisions and impact outcomes on whether or not a determination such as consequential as that should be made. That is a conversation that should be had between the President of the United States and this governing body on identifying the exact ways and methodologies in which what is prudent for federal investment and what is not.
The sudden shifts in leadership are not the only changes happening at FEMA. In April, thousands of AmeriCorps members were terminated as part of the Trump administration's DOGE efforts to shrink federal services. Those terminations included cutting FEMA Corps, a program under AmeriCorps where young adults support FEMA's disaster relief and readiness programs across the country. That includes assisting disaster survivors, managing grant logistics, and providing public services. Radio Catskill chatted with Sullivan County resident Henry Delacova, who was 4 months into his FEMA Corps assignment when he learned that he and his peers' positions had been eliminated.
We were assisting with Hurricane Helene recovery in North Carolina. And so basically we were working with the public assistance cadre, which what they do is like provide like grant assistance to towns and counties, stuff like that. So we were in their joint field office being support for their staff in terms of doing stuff with mapping and looking at different locations for potential grant funding and using their grants manager program to kind of check the status of grants and kind of move things forward like that, kind of general support and assistance.
Delacova was one of thousands of AmeriCorps team members who were in disbelief when they received the news in April, saying that some of his colleagues had already committed to a year-long program and didn't have anywhere to go after being laid off.
I mean, my initial reaction is kind of shock. It was a very sudden announcement. You know, just one random afternoon, we were told that we right away had to leave the office midday and start packing and preparing to go back. And you know, from when they told us to when we were on a flight back home was like 48 hours. So just kind of shock and disappointment. You know, there'd been a lot about DOGE and how it was affecting FEMA and stuff like this, but was not expecting such a sudden cut in terms of the AmeriCorps staff. So just shocked, sad. I was sad for my team members and for all of everything they've been through. You know, a lot of members use this program as because it's residential and they do get, you know, living stipend. They don't have like secure situations to go back to. So I had concern for them to have a sudden transition to find another place to live and figure out what they were going to do.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned that you were particularly supporting with Hurricane Helene efforts. What do these terminations mean for the communities that you serve?
Well, it just means that, you know, the money is going to get out to help them and help rebuild is going to get out of the door slower. It's already a long process. You know, we were there months after the hurricane, but the less staff that they have to process these funds, you know, there's a process that has to go through, you know, different requirements. And so the less people they have there to support that, the longer it'll take for these communities to rebuild.
Dilikova is worried about what's to come, given that hurricane and wildfire seasons are just around the corner. In addition to the AmeriCorps cuts, FEMA itself has laid off roughly 2,000 employees as part of the DOGE layoffs. The federal agency has also reduced training for state and local emergency managers that was meant to prepare storm-prone communities to handle the aftermath of hurricanes. Dilikova is concerned about the impact this will have on local communities on the ground.
I think it's going to have a negative impact. I mean, I don't think that DOGE is really thinking through the cuts. They're really doing a cut first, you know, consider it second approach. And so I think once we really get these stronger storms is when we'll start seeing the real impacts of these cuts. You know, they're doing things like they're cutting grants for resiliency. So like for communities to build more resilient infrastructure to prevent storm damage. So I think we're, you know, going to see more deaths and more lives impacted because of these cuts.
For recent graduates like Dilikova, the FEMA Corps program also gave him opportunity, something invaluable for young graduates. He's looking at state-level opportunities like emergency management or public service, but there's still a lot that remains unknown. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Kimberly. Now for news from Albany, where tomorrow the legislature will hold a special hearing on New York State's prison system. Lawmakers and criminal justice advocates are using the hearing as a chance to shed light on increased violence in correctional facilities. Here's Jung-Yoon Hong from the New York Public News Network.
The legislative hearing will focus on the violent deaths of inmates Robert Brooks and Masaya Nantui in two separate facilities in recent months. About 20 prison guards have been charged in connection to the deaths. Lawmakers will also question watchdogs and corrections officials on a three-week-long prison strike from earlier this year. It led the state to fire about 2,000 corrections officers. Melanie Bishop is a member of Community Care Alternatives. She says prisons have become increasingly unsafe for both incarcerated people and guards, and it's the right time for lawmakers to implement reforms.
I hope they focus on the fact that there needs to be transparency in those facilities.
Progressive leaders in the legislature are using the hearing as a chance to also push measures that didn't make it into this year's state budget, including the Earned Time Act. It would expand ways for individuals to accumulate good behavior credits to go towards early release. In Albany, I'm Jung-Yoon Han for the New York Public News Network.
Here at Radio Catskill, we're continuing to cover the 5 weeks late passage of the New York State budget. Governor Kathy Hochul was in Long Island today promoting several policy changes included in that $254 billion plan, including one of the items that she worked really hard to secure. The governor said other states should follow in New York's footsteps and ban cell phone usage during the day. With the passage of this budget, New York is now the largest state to enact such a limit, as a growing number of states consider their own bans.
I still remember sobbing my eyes out the first day of kindergarten, and I knew I would not talk to that child until the end of the day, and she would figure it out on her own, and she did. And now she's going to be a mom, and that baby will never even know that you could have had cell phones in schools. I want them banned all across this country.
And as reactions to New York's budget pour in from advocacy organizations and other groups, WAMC's Lucas Willard spoke with Pete Lopez, Executive Director of Policy Advocacy and Science at Scenic Hudson, about some of the environmental policy that was included and omitted from the final budget deal.
We're thankful for the governor's attention, for the attention of the legislature to protecting and stewarding our natural resources and ensuring that we have clean air, clean water. We're moving in a direction of sustainability. And again, we have confidence that this is a conscious effort, not just from the environmental leadership in the legislature, but from the legislature as a whole to protect and steward those important elements that we feel are needed to protect public health and safety and quality of life from an environmental public health standpoint.
One of the major environmental items in the budget is the continued support for the Clean Water Infrastructure Act. That's $500 million. That's a maintaining of funding. What can you tell me about the importance of this program and this investment that we're seeing, a total of $500 million for the fiscal year 2026 budget?
I can wear a Scenic Hudson hat, but I can also wear my former local official and former assembly and EPA hat. So ultimately, to meet clean water standards for surface water, for drinking water, for discharge, requires investment. So local officials who are involved with water and sewer point discharge, combined sewer overflows, drinking water systems, do their best, and they work under the guidance of DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation, and Department of Health to meet these standards. But ultimately, support is needed. State and federal funds are needed to try to make these systems meet these requirements and build new capacity where there are known threats to public health and safety. So these investments are critical, and I'm sure many colleagues would say that the need far outstrips the available resources, particularly as we, again, when we try to bring communities up to standards. Last piece I'll add is the science is constantly evolving. So as we talk about forever chemicals, now we have the consideration of PFAS, PFOA in the conversation too, and how do we protect drinking water sources and what additional mitigation is required there to be protective. So it's an evolving landscape, a lot of unmet need, and a critical role for state and federal partners.
Looking at the funding landscape for projects that are important to Scenic Hudson in New York State amid a changing regulatory environment at the federal level, are there any programs in New York that you find particularly important right now as there is changing or proposed changes to environmental regulations, what's being discussed by the current administration?
I would say that we've had a fair amount of conversation in and around the area of land conservation, including farmland conservation. So the Scenic Hudson, again, with its land conservation team, does work to leverage private funds and working with private landowners with federal sources of funding. And that has been an area of question as to, you know, the availability of funds and the ultimate amount of funds that could be made available for such conservation. So there is concern around that. We are monitoring that and assessing how that fits within our teams and the land conservation model that Scenic Hudson uses. Beyond that, we certainly do pay attention and are concerned about federal funding for clean water infrastructure. We are very much focused on funding for remediation. And I'll just say we're focused on staffing because part of it is not just dollar allocations, also staffing available to help support and advance outcomes. So as we look at key agencies, EPA, for example, USDA and others, we are concerned about what does that mean in terms of program availability, program support, flow of funding, timeliness of funding. So those are some issues that we're monitoring and continue to assess. Much of it's playing out in real time in front of us, as you know.
Now, there's also $425 million, which is a record for the Environmental Protection Fund. And a lot of the programs in the EPF grants, they're flexible. There's a lot of different ways that recipients can use this funding. Why is it valuable to have that, one, have that funding, but two, have that funding be made available for a variety of projects?
So to the extent that the EPF is a known and respected source of dedicated funding, that is really paramount to the environmental community. So protecting the sanctity, the integrity of the EPF for all those purposes that you mentioned remains really a beacon, a critical consideration for environmental protection, for land use conservation, for investment in farms, for sustainability. So to the extent that fund was grown, again, their folks are celebrating an investment. It's been a long time since the EPF has been increased, and it gives more opportunity to have dedicated funding on a year-to-year basis with some degree of certainty that these dollars will be available. So for any organization to have some certainty or some sense of fund availability helps with planning and developing outcomes and initiating projects and reaching out to other potential participants and stakeholders. So it's very much a galvanizing and a catalyst to drive these actions statewide.
Is there anything that Scenic Hudson advocated for that didn't make it into the final budget?
Yes. Open Space Institute and others were heavily involved in trying to address one key element, in particular that of title insurance. And in that regard, there was a call from a statutory perspective, making clear that the legislature and the governor were encouraging the use of third-party title insurance to help facilitate more rapid movement of conservation from nonprofits and others into state holdings. That particular item has not gained the traction we had hoped. There have been some challenges working within various levels of government, and again, just making sure that we have concurrence with the Attorney General. That has been, still remains out of reach. Many states have third-party title insurance. It provides an additional support to the process, and we maintain would help expedite and streamline the process of conserving lands across New York. So that's an item we're still focusing on. We need to come back and debrief as an environmental community, land conservation community. But that would be one notable item that didn't make it across the finish line.
Thanks again, Pete Lopez, for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, and we hold you folks in high regard, so happy to hear from you.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Yes, this is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. As cases of preventable diseases like measles are rising across the country, nearly 900 reported so far this year alone, public health experts are warning of the serious consequences tied to deep cuts in public health funding. Dr. Richard Besser, president and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and former acting director of the CDC, has been sounding the alarm about the decline in public health infrastructure and what it means for vaccine access and the health of communities. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio has more.
You served in leadership roles at the CDC and now at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. How have you seen the public health landscape change in the recent years, especially around the vaccine education?
I think one of the biggest changes and one of the most concerning changes is over the past decade, a decline in trust in public health, in our government, in those who are in positions that are supposed to be focused on protecting and preserving the health of everyone in our country. With the COVID pandemic, we saw incredible politicization of public health, where we had political leaders verbally, vocally, loudly pushing back on the measures that public health was trying to put in place to protect people's health. And with that, people's trust has gone down significantly.
As you say that we just had a notification here in Sullivan County that Orange County, our neighboring county, just had 3 cases of measles confirmed. So there was an advisory sent out in our area. And we posted it on our social media And already an argument started brewing in the comment section, folks saying that don't take the vaccine, don't vaccine your kids, things like that. It seems like that those conversations are still happening. And so what do you think are the biggest challenges right now in getting accurate, trusted vaccine information out to the public?
Yeah, in addition to working in public health, I'm also a general pediatrician and practiced pediatrics for more than 30 years. And there was nothing I did as a pediatrician I know that had more proven value for the health and safety of the children I was taking care of than making sure they were vaccinated fully and on time. And to make that happen, I would spend a lot of time answering the questions that parents would have, because you should have questions and you should ask those questions and you should get them answered by someone you trust and someone who knows you and your family, not from social media. And unfortunately, not from our Secretary of Health, who before becoming Secretary of Health did more than just about anyone to create misinformation, to spread misinformation, and to undermine people's trust in this life-saving, life-protecting measure, which is vaccination.
And how dangerous is what's going on now with the rhetoric now for the current administration and message they're sending out there now?
Yeah, it's extremely dangerous. Over the course of my career, there were so many diseases that I saw go away. So I remember early in my career taking care of many children who had meningitis, which is an infection that involves the spinal cord and the brain. That went away as vaccines were developed. I've done a lot of work overseas, and measles used to kill millions of children every year around the globe. And it was eliminated from the United States and many countries decades ago through the use of vaccination. Now, as you're saying, we're now over 1,000 cases. And the thing about measles, it's so incredibly contagious. It doesn't respect borders. So most of the cases are in Texas. But as you're saying, you're seeing a couple. Those couple will grow if there are communities, if there are schools where the vaccine levels aren't above about 95%. It's that contagious. So it's a challenge. What I say is, ask someone who really knows about what you should do for your children. And that is your child's doctor, your child's nurse, your pharmacist, someone who really is part of your community and knows your child. And don't listen to the noise out there from people who are spreading a lot of falsehoods.
Yeah. Now, like we just said, with the recent funding cuts to local health departments, what do you think are going to be the long-term risks? What do you see emerging from all this?
One of the things that attracted me to a career in public health, and one of the wonderful things about public health, is that it cares about every single person in the community. It's about providing an opportunity for not just the wealthy to be healthy, but everyone. We believe that health shouldn't be a privilege, but a right. As you cut these programs, what you're going to see is that people who have money will have a choice. People who don't will not. Because what dries up are our clinics, vaccine clinics that come into communities and provide opportunities. You have a family where the parents are working two or three jobs. They need a clinic that's in their community that's available on their hours to make sure their child gets vaccinated. Because in America, so many people are having to choose between their hours on the job and putting food on the table and getting to that visit, getting to that clinic. During COVID, we saw major outreach with clinics set up in churches and community centers, and that helped increase the vaccination rate dramatically. With these major cuts, you know, this Department of Health and Human Services has cut billions of dollars in funding across the country, and that will lead to a have and have not situation in our nation, and that should never be.
Yeah. So what do you say to those people who are unsure or hesitant about sticking to the recommended vaccine schedule for their children?
Yeah, there is a lot of noise out there. And parents want to do the right thing. Talk to your child's doctor. Talk to your child's nurse. Talk to your child's pharmacist and get those questions answered. Because I think when you do, you will decide that getting your child vaccinated fully and on time is the best thing you can do to protect their health. We saw this was a very severe season of flu. One of the reasons that it was so bad was that vaccine coverage rates were quite low. And what we're going to see with measles is that the number of cases is going to grow. And unfortunately, we're going to see more children or adults who have immune problems suffer very bad consequences from that.
Do you understand that some groups in America might be hesitant to take the vaccine because of past you know, mistakes.
That's right. You know, as a foundation, a lot of our work was focused on trying to move our public health system and our healthcare system to be systems that meet the needs of everyone in communities, because they haven't been. How do you create them as systems that are trustworthy for everyone? And for many Black and Brown communities, they haven't been. And as we see this administration destroy the public health system that we had, we need a vision of how to build it back better to be a system that is trustworthy and meets the needs of everyone, because it did not before. And what we saw with COVID was that vaccination efforts were most successful where they were led by members of each community. So Black health leaders coming into predominantly Black communities with a message of, here's why we think you should get vaccinated. Very effective. And so while I don't think this administration is going to move in that direction, we have to put forward a vision of what our healthcare system could be, what our public health system could be, so that it's meeting the needs of everybody.
Right. As you're saying, like, the nationally, the support might not be there for vaccines, but what can the role of community leaders, and you mentioned like local institutions, pay in playing in combating what's going on with the vaccine education?
I think that the voices of community leaders at the local level can be very effective. Faith leaders can be very effective at helping parents make the right decision about their children's health. The federal government is pretty far removed from people's lives, and people's trust is quite variable, and in most cases is going down. So the more you can look to local leaders, and there are leaders in every community, the more you're going to be able to protect. One of the other challenges is with the cuts in federal funding, it's going to be harder to monitor and even see when some of these diseases are in the community. And you have to be on the lookout for something like measles, because when it shows up, vaccinating and having extra vaccination clinics can be a very effective way at stopping the spread when it is there.
Are there any examples of communities that are doing the right thing when it comes to vaccine education and access?
There are. The challenge is it's a moving target. So even in Texas, which has had over 700 cases of measles, trying to do the right thing, the big cuts in federal funding have led them to have to get rid of 20 public health workers. And those public health workers are individuals who are designed and trained to do community outreach. They've had to cancel more than 50 vaccine clinics. And those are clinics in communities where they're trying to meet the needs of communities that where individuals may not have the health insurance to be able to go to their private doctor. So it's worth paying attention to what your local public health department is doing. And if you're in a community that where you're concerned about the outreach, see what kind of efforts you can do. Look to the organizations you're part of. What community groups are you part of? And ask the question, what can we do to make sure our community is not one that gets hit by something that's so incredibly preventable?
Doctor, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on? Do you want folks to know?
One thing, I'm deeply concerned about the proposed cuts to Medicaid, which are just being announced. One of the big things in the new proposal is a requirement that people on Medicaid document that they're working. It's a very small percentage of people who are on Medicaid who are able to work who aren't working. Largely, it's older women who have care responsibilities that make it hard for them to work. But what happens when these work requirements come in is that people who are working two jobs, three jobs to put it together, lose their Medicaid coverage because they don't have the time every month to go in and sit and show their receipts that they are working. They don't have the time or may not have the broadband access to go online and complete the forms to show that they're working. So they lose their insurance. And so you see hardworking people across America who are going to lose their insurance, which means they're not going to have a regular provider. They're going to have to wait until they're really, really sick to go to the emergency room. They're going to lose the opportunities to get vaccinated. And we just have to say no. People deserve to have health insurance. We are the wealthiest nation in the world, and we do the worst job of any wealthy nation in ensuring the health of our population.
We're talking to Dr. Besser, President and CEO of Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and former acting director of the CDC, about the rise in preventable diseases cases and then sharp cuts to public health departments. Thank you so much for talking to us. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it as well.
Thank you, Patricio. Well, that's it for the Local Edition. I've been your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. I will be back here tomorrow night. We'll do it all over again. We got Mr. Kusar Grace coming up at 7 with the Music Emporium kicking up our music lineup, but we still have more news on the way. Stay with us now for the Daily